This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. It's 3 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 6 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Coming up on today's programme, we'll be dedicating a large portion of today's show to the attack in London yesterday, which has left 4 dead and over 20 taken to hospital with injuries, many critical. We'll have a report on what happened yesterday afternoon and a look at the response in London. Some questions are being raised over the media management by authorities of events following the terrorist attack that took place around the British Houses of Parliament, leading one major British broadcaster to wrongly identify the suspect shot dead by police. We'll be asking if rolling 24-hour news and instant social media coverage mean mistakes are often inevitable. Also on today's show, a new study by the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, or ISPU, seeks to offer insight into the often marginalised and misrepresented Muslim community in America. We'll be hearing from the director of the ISPU, Dalia Mogahid, about the findings of this new report. And we'll be talking about Brahma, a new feathery internet sensation. All that and more over the next hour on this Thursday edition of World in Focus.
Yesterday, an act of terrorism tried to silence our democracy. But today we meet as normal, as generations have done before us and as future generations will continue to do, to deliver a simple message. We are not afraid.
The UK Prime Minister Theresa May addressing Parliament in London this morning, just 19 hours after the horrific incidents of yesterday afternoon in Westminster, which left 4 dead and between 20 to 40 injured. To bring us up to speed with those events and what we now know, here's Jack Foster.
It was around 2:40 UK time yesterday when initial reports of gunfire started to emerge from Westminster in London, the seat of the UK Parliament. In the hours that followed, news began to unfold, which painted a fuller picture of the horrific events that had gripped central London yesterday afternoon. What we know now is that a lone attacker mounted the pavement of Westminster Bridge, which approaches the House of Commons from the east. Driving a grey 4x4 saloon car, the as-yet unidentified man killed 2 pedestrians and injured anywhere up to 40 more before crashing into the railings by carriage gates at New Palace Yard, just below the iconic clock tower of Big Ben. The attacker then ran towards the Parliament armed with a knife and was ultimately shot dead by armed police officers at the scene, though not before a confrontation with unarmed police, during which Officer Keith Palmer was stabbed and killed. That news was confirmed yesterday evening by Acting Deputy Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, Mark Rowley.
Today in Westminster, we saw tragic events unfold, and our thoughts are with those who lost loved ones, those who were injured, and all those affected by this attack. One of those who died today was a police officer, PC Keith Palmer, a member of our Parliamentary and Diplomatic Protection Command. Keith, aged 48, had 15 years service and was a husband and a father. He was someone who left for work today expecting to return home at the end of his shift, and he had every right to expect that would happen.
Mark Rowley, Deputy Commissioner of the London Metropolitan Police, speaking to journalists last night. And the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, released a statement last night praising the work of the emergency services, as well as paying tribute to PC Keith Palmer.
My heart goes out to those who've lost loved ones and to everyone who's been affected. Tragically, a Metropolitan Police officer who is doing his duty protecting our city is amongst those who've been killed. And my thoughts are with his family this evening. I want to express my gratitude on behalf of all Londoners to the police and emergency services who've shown tremendous bravery in exceptionally difficult circumstances. Londoners should be aware that there will be additional armed and unarmed police officers on our streets from tonight in order to keep Londoners and all those visiting our city safe. I want to reassure all Londoners and all our visitors not to be alarmed. Our city remains one of the safest in the world. London is the greatest city in the world, and we stand together in the face of those who seek to harm us and destroy our way of life. We always have and we always will. Londoners will never be cowed by terrorism.
London Mayor Sadiq Khan speaking last night in response to the attack in Westminster yesterday afternoon. Within hours, a statement emerged from Washington, D.C. via U.S. President Donald Trump's White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer.
We obviously condemn today's attack in Westminster, which the United Kingdom is treating as an act of terrorism. And we applaud the quick response that the British police and their first responders made to the situation. The victims are in our thoughts and our prayers. The City of London and Her Majesty's government have the full support of the U.S. government in responding to the attack and bringing those to justice who are responsible.
U.S. President Donald Trump's press secretary, Sean Spicer, addressing members of the press yesterday evening in response to the attack outside of the UK Parliament in Westminster, London. This morning, there was a great deal of effort in the House of Commons to make it clear that business would continue as normal, unaffected by the events of the previous day. That said, the beginning of the day was marked by a somber mood of reflection and a minute's silence in the chamber, initiated by the House of Commons speaker. Speaker John Bercow.
We shall now observe a minute's silence.
The UK Parliament this morning holding a minute's silence to honour the victims of yesterday's attack in Westminster. And that silence was observed simultaneously at Scotland Yard, the headquarters of London's Metropolitan Police, and at the Scottish Parliament in Edinburgh. After that silence, the Parliament quickly moved on to the normal business of the day in what many saw as a show of defiance, illustrating that the day-to-day business of UK democracy would not be impacted by events. 1 hour later, at around 10:30 UK time, the Prime Minister, Theresa May, delivered a statement to the House of Commons, the highlights of which we can hear now.
Yesterday, an act of terrorism tried to silence our democracy. But today we meet as normal, as generations have done before us and as future generations will continue to do, to deliver a simple message. We are not afraid, and our resolve will never waver in the face of terrorism. And we meet here in the oldest of all parliaments because we know that democracy and the values it entails will always prevail. Those values, free speech, liberty, human rights and the rule of law, are embodied here in this place, but they are shared by free people around the world. A terrorist came to the place where people of all nationalities and cultures gather to celebrate what it means to be free. And he took out his rage indiscriminately against innocent men, women and children. Mr. Speaker, this was an attack on free people everywhere. And on behalf of the British people, I would like to thank our friends and allies around the world who have made it clear that they stand with us at this time. In addition to 12 Britons admitted to hospital, we know that the victims include 3 French children, 2 Romanians, 4 South Koreans, 1 German, 1 Pole, 1 Irish, 1 Chinese, 1 Italian, 1 American, and 2 Greeks. And we are in close contact with the governments of the countries of all those affected. Tragically, as the House will know, 48-year-old PC Keith Palmer was killed. PC Palmer had devoted his life to the service of his country. He had been a member of the Parliamentary and Diplomatic Protection Command for 15 years and a soldier in the Royal Artillery before that. He was a husband and a father, killed doing a job he loved. He was every inch a hero, and his actions will never be forgotten. Mr. Speaker, at 7:30 last night, I chaired a meeting of the government's Emergency Committee, COBRA, and will have further briefings and meetings with security officials today. The threat level to the UK has been set at severe, meaning attack is highly likely for some time. This is the second highest threat level. The highest level, critical, means there is specific intelligence that an attack is imminent. As there is no such intelligence, the Independent Joint Terrorism Analysis Centre has decided that the threat level will not change in the light of yesterday's attack. A full counter-terrorism investigation is already underway. Hundreds of our police and security officers have been working through the night to establish everything possible about this attack, including its preparation, motivation, and whether there were any associates involved in its planning. And while there remain limits on what I can say at this stage, I can confirm that overnight the police have searched 6 addresses and made 8 arrests in Birmingham and London. Mr. Speaker, it is still believed that this attacker acted alone, and the police have no reason to believe there are imminent further attacks on the public. His identity is known to the police and MI5, and when operational considerations allow, he will be publicly identified. What I can confirm is that the man was British-born and that some years ago he was once investigated by MI5 in relation to concerns about violent extremism. He was a peripheral figure. The case is historic. He was not part of the current intelligence picture. There was no prior intelligence of his intent or of the plot. Intensive investigations continue. Mr. Speaker, we know the threat from Islamist terrorism is very real. But while the public should remain utterly vigilant, they should not and will not be cowed by this threat. As Acting Deputy Commissioner Rowley has made clear, we are stepping up policing to protect communities across the country and to reassure the public. And as a precautionary measure, this will mean increasing the number of patrols in cities across the country, with more police and more armed police on the streets. Mr. Speaker, yesterday we saw the worst of humanity, but we will remember the best. We will remember the extraordinary efforts to save the life of PC Keith Palmer, including those by my right honourable friend, the member for Bournemouth East. And we will remember the exceptional bravery of our police, security and emergency services, who once again ran towards the danger, even as they encouraged others to move the other way. On behalf of the whole country, I want to pay tribute to them for the work they have been doing to reassure the public, treat the injured and bring security back to the streets of our capital city. That they have lost one of their own in yesterday's attack only makes their calmness and professionalism all the more remarkable. But the greatest response lies not in the words of politicians, but in the everyday actions of ordinary people. For beyond these walls today, in scenes repeated in towns and cities across the country, millions of people are going about their days and getting on with their lives. The streets are as busy as ever, the offices full, the coffee shops and cafes bustling. As I speak, millions will be boarding trains and aeroplanes to travel to London and to see for themselves the greatest city on earth. It is in these actions, millions of acts of normality, that we find the best response to terrorism. A response that denies our enemies their victory, that refuses to let them win, that shows we will never give in. A response driven by that same spirit that drove a husband and father to put himself between us and our attacker and to pay the ultimate price. A response that says to the men and women who propagate this hate and evil, you will not defeat us.
The Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Theresa May, speaking this morning to the House of Commons following yesterday's attack, which took place just outside of Parliament in London. So just over 24 hours on, and we do have a clearer sense of exactly what happened. Thus far, four people have been killed. That's including the assailant. And the most up-to-date information available from London Ambulance Service suggests that 23 people were hospitalised with serious injuries. And from the Prime Minister's statement this morning, we also know that seven of those are currently in a critical condition. Tributes have begun pouring in for the victims and their families, as well as for the emergency services who attended yesterday. Overnight and into today, flowers have been laid at the scene on Westminster Bridge as life in London goes on amidst the now familiar refrain, "We are not afraid." Jack Foster, World in Focus.
And Jack Foster joins me in the studio now. Now, Jack, information is still coming out about this attack constantly, and I believe you have an update for us.
I think that obviously we'll be likely to see information coming out for the days and weeks to come. At the moment, this afternoon alone anyway, what we can say is, first of all, as well as those held at Westminster, Scotland Yard and the Scottish Parliament this morning, as was mentioned in the report there, there was also a minute's silence held at the UN this afternoon. That was held just over an hour ago from now. Now, information on the attack itself is obviously still very thin on the ground. But earlier this afternoon, IS or Daesh have claimed responsibility. Obviously, that comes with the caveat that they would always have been likely to claim responsibility for any such attack of this sort. So quite how much credence we can put in that, who can say. Early reports are now emerging that the car which was used was hired from a firm in Birmingham, which is 100 miles from London. We don't know any more than that, but it is probably connected to arrests which we know have already been made in connection to the attack over the past 24 hours. And as far as the scene itself is concerned in Westminster in London, Westminster Bridge has reopened. That happened around two hours ago, as has Westminster Tube Station. Now, in the midst of all this, of course, we shouldn't forget that the most tragic part of it all, and we can now confirm the names of all three of the victims from yesterday's attack. In addition to the police officer, Keith Palmer, the names of the two people killed yesterday on Westminster Bridge have now been released. Those are Aisha Fraid, a 43-year-old mother of two who, as we understand, was crossing Westminster Bridge to collect her children from school when she was killed. And just in the last couple of hours, the second victim was named as Kurt Cochran, a US national who was visiting London as part of a trip around Europe celebrating his 25th wedding anniversary. His wife, Melissa, is still in hospital with serious injuries, although she is expected to recover.
Of course, thoughts with those affected. Thank you very much, Jack.
Breaking news, expert analysis and exclusive stories all in one place. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. On the programme, we'll be continuing our coverage of the terror attack in London yesterday outside the UK's Houses of Parliament. We'll be back with you in just a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me back, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist,
troublemaker and muckraker from bradblog.com.
Join me for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik, we'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys.
When and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik.
I'm Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Tune in!
Well, maybe mention like central bankers and you know, markets are doubling down. Not, you're saying everybody's doubling down. They're crazy.
They are. Everyone's crazy.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter.
We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at sputniknews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back to World in Focus. Still to come on today's programme, we'll be discussing the response to yesterday's attacks in London with our reporter in London, Jim Ensom. We'll also be looking at some of the questions being raised over the media management by authorities of events following the terrorist attack, which caused one major British broadcaster to wrongly identify the suspect that shot dead by police. We'll be asking if rolling 24-hour news and instant social media coverage means mistakes are often inevitable. We're going to go over now to our reporter, Jim Ensom, who is in London. Now, Jim, we saw the hashtag We Are Not Afraid trending last night, a show of defiance from the people of London against terrorism. What exactly is the mood like in London today?
I was reminded very much of the scenes way back in 2005. I was in London for the 7/7 bombings, and I was commuting every day to London in the aftermath of it. And the situation today is exactly the same as it was then. Basically, London is shocked by these things, but London is resilient. Londoners, of course, went through the Blitz in the Second World War. In the 70s, we had the IRA bombing campaigns. They bombed the Houses of Parliament. They bombed at Madame Tussauds. They bombed at the Tower of London. This was back in the 1970s. I was a schoolboy at that stage, and I was due to be at the Tower of London on the day, but the trip was cancelled, unbelievably. And on the 6th of July, 2005, that was the day that London was announced as being the venue for the 2012 Olympics. And that night, this was the day before the bombings, that evening I was strolling through London and everyone was out on the streets. The sun was shining. Everyone had a smile on their faces. Everyone was saying hello to the newspaper sellers, and it was a wonderful feeling. And then the Red Arrows flew across London. It was a delightful moment, and London was great. The following morning, everything changed. The four bombs went off and the feeling was tense. That day, everyone survived. There was all sorts of chaos, but the next day we went to work. Londoners do. Okay, Carolyn, for the next few days, it was tense on the underground. It was quieter than usual. And everyone was watching everyone, and there was nervousness. And that's the feeling that is on London today. But gradually, gradually, London will get back. London and Londoners are resilient.
Mm. Now, I know that you, Jim, previously undertook some training related to emergency response situations. And from your experience, how effective do you think that the police response was yesterday?
Well, at the time of the London bombings, I was the editor of a magazine called Survive, and it was aimed at practitioners in emergency response and disaster recovery. And I worked very closely with the emergency services and the military over those years and did training with the police and the blue light services, as we call them. We learned a lot of lessons from 7/7. One of them was communications. There was a communications fault. That's been cleared up. And since then, there have been lots and lots of rehearsals for such incidents, right, left and center. There's a new blue light communications radio system, which is far better. There are far more CCTV cameras around, and particularly, of course, around the Palace of Westminster. So the reality was, as I was watching it unfold yesterday, I had about seven screens, and I was watching everything, and I was in the Met Police Twitter feed and everything. It was fast. Remember, they were there already. There were armed guards at the Palace of Westminster, and the man, the attacker, who we haven't heard the official name of yet, but the attacker only got a few meters in before he was shot dead. And the fact of the matter is the police, the fire and the ambulance and all the services were there literally within seconds. They were already there, some of them. They called in the troops and had backups. It's useful that St. Thomas's Hospital, with all of its expertise, was at the south end of Westminster Bridge. And I thought that the response was absolutely superb. And the fact that they did a complete lockdown of the palaces and of the surrounding roads, and they extended that lockdown to Horsefree Road, Northumberland Avenue and the Mall, they quickly have the area in total lockdown and in total control in very, very swift time. It was an amazing response by the security services and the blue light services, and I think it's a credit to them that it was all brought under control so easily. Many people would have seen it as chaos, but for those of us who are practitioners in these things, it was a well-executed routine.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Prime Minister, Theresa May, of course, held a COBRA meeting, as Jack mentioned a minute ago in his report. Now, can you just help us understand what exactly that is and what that means?
It's a lovely term. COBRA stands for Cabinet Office Briefing Room A, and it's one of the briefing rooms in 70 Whitehall. That's around the back of Downing Street, or the front's Whitehall, and there's a connection between it and Downing Street, and they can go underground to get into that room. And it's a room with a long table, rather like the Situation Room in the basement of the West Wing. It's a long table where they all sit round, and it's got audiovisual screens where they can have live links and everything. And that's where the briefing takes place. So COBRA is Cabinet Office Briefing Room A, and it can take place, generally speaking, in that particular room. It's attended, and that would have been chaired by the Prime Minister. It can sometimes be chaired by the Home Secretary, or in any emergency by the most senior politician of whatever the emergency is. And when we had the BSE crisis, they had COBRA meetings. That was the cattle feed problem that happened a few years ago. They would have been chaired by the Secretary of State for Agriculture or something like that. But in this case, Theresa May would have been surrounded by GCHQ, head of MI5, MI6, the Mayor of London, the Metropolitan Police, and all of those who were involved at the very top level. We call it the gold level of all of the incident command. And that is why it's called COBRA. And that's where the great strategy is set out.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, with regards to the attack yesterday, a strategy to look into those kind of attacks is very difficult to find. This, what we can say is this didn't look like a well-organised, thought-out attack. It looked like there was no thought gone into it, really. Now, right now, to stop these kind of attacks, we really have to be looking at the reasons for extremism and radicalisation rather than, you know, limiting or increasing security at airports and things like that. Is that something that COBRA would be doing, or is that something that only the government can really take legislation forward on?
COBRA quite clearly, I was listening to Theresa May in the House this morning. Quite clearly, they decided at the COBRA meeting yesterday not to increase the security level, which at the moment is at severe. It's not at critical, which is the highest level. They've decided that the incident was of its own and that there are no further threats. We still remain that a threat is there. It's still obviously severe, but they haven't increased it, which means that they haven't got any actual intelligence of anything about to happen. It's only that an attack is highly likely. That's what severe means. So at the COBRA meeting, they decided they weren't going to increase it. But of course, we've been on severe since, I think it was about 2014. The level hasn't changed since then, which means that there is heightened security at ports, airports, and around places like the Palace of Westminster, that they're increasing that for the next few days because they want to give guidance. But the balance with all of these things is you've got to keep London open and you've got to keep the roads going. They've opened Westminster Bridge this morning. They cleaned it up this morning and that bridge is now open and traffic is now moving. London gets back to itself. You cannot close off everything just because of one terrorist attack, because that basically gives in to terrorism. If you close London down completely and make it totally secure, you'd be having airport checks at every single tube station. You'd be having airport checks at all the main terminuses on the train system. That can't happen. So you have to get that balance between, you know, what it is possible to do and allowing Britain to keep doing what it wants, to allow the freedoms. And London, as I've said before, is resilient. We've been here before, we've done it before, and they keep London streets as safe as they can. Just remember, it was once said famously, you can do many, many things for your freedoms, but the bomber will always get through.
Mm. Well, Jim Ensign, thank you very much for speaking to me today. And there's, of course, certainly no shortage of solidarity with the people of London, across the UK and across the globe today.
We are above all the latest developments, and we don't take any sides. Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Now, more than 24 hours since the devastating London terror attack, and the suspect shot dead by police is still to be officially named. His identity has been the subject of widespread and perhaps not entirely accurate reporting by the mainstream media, including one prominent and respected British broadcaster. But in the 24-hour social and mainstream media cycle, are mistakes like this inevitable? Our reporter Mark Hurst has been finding out.
In the media aftermath of yesterday's terrorist attack in London, social media was awash with photographs, videos and eyewitness accounts from the scene. Mainstream media also swung into action, but the overall picture remained and remains confusing. Almost 24 hours after the attack that left four people dead and as many as 40 injured of various nationalities, the identity of the attacker is yet to be officially disclosed. And it was amid this confusion that one respected broadcaster, Channel 4 News, went live to claim a source had confirmed to them the identity of the suspect who was shot dead by police. But by the end of the hour-long broadcast, shown live across the UK, their senior Home Affairs correspondent, Simon Israel, was forced to retract the claim.
I appeared quite certain earlier in the programme, but there appears to be some doubt now. A source was pretty certain that the attacker, who was shot dead by police, was, as I earlier said, who has a long history of extremism in this country. It now appears that that might not be the case. It might be someone else, owing to the fact that new information has emerged to suggest that is still in prison, having being served a sentence, having been arrested and detained 2 years ago and then brought back to this country to serve another sentence. So it may be that we're not as certain as we were about the identity of this attacker, of this so-called lone wolf, who's carried out complete carnage on Westminster Bridge this afternoon and has stabbed to death a police officer.
Simon Israel there. As the broadcast went out live, Channel 4 News appears to have been called by the brother of the man they named in their report. He claimed his brother was still in jail and therefore could not have carried out the Westminster attack. But curiously, neither the Metropolitan Police nor the Ministry of Defence would either confirm or deny that the person named by Channel 4 News and several other mainstream media outlets was the same man police had shot dead in the grounds of Westminster Palace. So in the age of 24-hour rolling news, combined with the pressure from social media, are mistakes like the one made by Channel 4 News inevitable? Well, joining me now is Professor Helen Fenwick, expert in media and counter-terrorist law at the University of Durham. Professor Fenwick, the attacks in London yesterday were not unexpected, but that didn't prevent a range of conflicting information emerging about the attacks being broadcast and printed. Should the authorities be doing more to provide accurate and timely information to the public to prevent erroneous or false stories emerging?
Well, in principle, yes, but as I understand it, the identity of the attacker is being kept secret for the time being because, I assume, in order to not alert any associates of that person, because they could be subject to arrest. And therefore, obviously, if they don't release the identity, then they are more likely to be able to catch certain people who are, you know, in a way unawares. And as I understand it, one of the inaccuracies was that someone was identified in the media who was not the person, because the person who was identified is in prison, so obviously couldn't have perpetrated the attack. So that was a mistake. And it's also true to say, I suppose, that in the immediate aftermath, there was uncertainty as whether there might have been a second attacker who could have been, you know, might have been in the car, etc., which perhaps that kind of confusion may sometimes be unavoidable because you've got an unfolding situation that's developing rapidly, and it may be possible that somebody could have been involved, and I suppose that gets reported, which is not in fact accurate. So in general, I agree with, obviously, accurate information should be released if it can be, but there may sometimes be security reasons why that it has to be withheld for at least a short period of time.
What potential legal consequences do media organisations face when they incorrectly link an individual to an alleged crime in this way?
Well, they could be subject to defamation proceedings in theory. If they retract it immediately, that's not particularly likely, which as far as I understand it, in this case, they did, or retracted it rapidly. I don't know the exact timescale. But in theory, as I say, it is possible. There could be defamation. There could be a complaint, obviously, to a media watchdog, so such as Ofcom. So, yeah, there could be legal consequences. I suspect in most instances there wouldn't be, but they would at least they're there as a possibility.
Both the Metropolitan Police and the Ministry of Justice will neither confirm or deny the identity of the suspect in this incident yesterday and would not rule out, despite the Channel 4 News retraction, that the individual they named was not the suspect who was shot. When individuals are incorrectly identified by media organisations, do the authorities not have an obligation to clarify that if they are certain a named individual is not linked to an incident like the one that occurred yesterday, they should say so?
Yeah, I would say that they should do. I mean, certainly, for example, the Ofcom Code of Practice would state that if there are inaccuracies or misleading information is given, then it ought to be corrected. It all depends, however, what the reason is for not putting the record straight about this person. If what I just said before is correct, that the person is actually in prison, it's hard for me to see what the person that was named is in prison. It's hard for me to see what purpose there could be in withholding that information. So I'm somewhat confused about that. But I think they, broadly speaking, they do have such an obligation, yeah.
When it comes to breaking news, it often seems as if news organisations are playing catch-up to social media. That is inevitably going to put pressure on journalists and editors to publish what they know as soon as they have it. Are we likely to see more errors being made in future because of that pressure?
Because they have to react quickly. I suppose the answer has to be yes, in the sense that social media is, obviously we're already living in a kind of social media age, but it's getting more, it's proliferating even more. The usage of it is happening much more, and more people are members of different types of social media, different platforms, etc. So therefore, if that is putting pressure on, as you say, the sort of traditional journalists to get their own story out there rapidly, I can only see that pressure increasing. And so I suppose mistakes of that nature may become more probable because they've got less time to check sources, etc.
And how would you assess the media management of the authorities in this case from what you've seen so far, and other aspects of it that you would you think they might learn from in future?
I think at this point it's very difficult to assess the media management. I mean, what we've seen is obviously a variety of headlines. Obviously, it's been discussed, in various forums, and discussed obviously on the radio, etc., etc. And I haven't heard, apart from that inaccuracy that we're talking about, I haven't heard anything that I would say was particularly surprising. So perhaps in terms of learning from, how this has happened, what I think could be said is the authorities need to consider, maybe media bodies need to be involved as well. This kind of incident, unfortunately, could happen again. We haven't had a terrorist attack of this nature, as you know, in the UK for about 10 years. So possibly, we had one incident, of course, the Lee Rigby incident, but that obviously killing, but that's the only one. So therefore, it's possible that we have got some lessons to learn about the kind of management of a situation like this, a developing situation, and maybe, the media in itself maybe needs to be represented in some forum, just trying to work out the sort of ways of reacting to try and avoid inaccuracies or misleading information, etc.
Professor Helen Fenwick there, an expert in media and counter-terrorist law at Durham University. Well, joining me now is Phil Hall, a former tabloid newspaper editor who now runs PHA Media, a public relations and media management firm in London. Phil Hall, how would you assess the media management that the Met and the Ministry of Defence have demonstrated over this incident, given that there are quite a few contradictory reports of what took place yesterday?
I think it's a very difficult situation, especially in the modern age when you've got members of the public taking photographs, video film, and the story changing as it happens. And I think one of the great difficulties we also have with 24-hour TV is that the police and authorities don't have time to think. So they're very much trying to manage this on their feet. And what has happened is, in many ways, they've become a little bit more defensive than they would normally be. Certainly yesterday, the police were keeping all of their cards very close to their chest and refusing to reveal any detail because I think they were concerned that the story would run away with itself.
And you mentioned social media there. with it being so instant and immediate, is there a danger that media management planning can quickly become undermined by speculation on social media?
Yeah, I mean, you can only plan the media management so much because every incident is different, and clearly one happening can change things, because if a reporter comes across an eyewitness or a particular situation develops and the journalist gets it first, it's very difficult for the media then to be managed, as you would say, because the story's already running. I mean, it's live on Twitter, it's live on social media, so media management is more difficult than it's ever been.
And why do official organisations have to be so careful about the information they release into the public? I mean, what are the legal and ethical issues around that?
Legal issues are, I mean, it can be very difficult. I mean, I've certainly been in situations in my past as a newspaper editor where reporters were knocking on doors just aimlessly hoping to try and get information on a particular story, only to find the person whose door that they knocked on became a witness later on in the proceedings. And then newspapers are then accused of interfering with the legal process. So it is very, very difficult. I think in the new social media age, all the rules really have gone out the window. I think it's just a case of trying to use common sense. Clearly, the police were urging the journalists yesterday not to reveal identities of the terrorists for obvious reasons. And I think generally editors will cooperate, particularly following the Leveson inquiry, where everyone's on warning really that they must behave properly. So it's a case of common sense, but every editor has to make their own decisions.
And is there likely to be a review of how the media management was handled in this case, and what lessons do you think they might learn from that?
I think you'll find that they review the situation after every big incident, but I'm not sure there are many lessons to learn. I think social media is with us. We can't turn the clock back. You can't ban people posting video up on Twitter and on social media accounts. It's going to happen. And I think one of the contradictions yesterday was when first the film started to appear, there were many people on social media criticising the filmmakers for taking pictures and not helping the victims. And yet later in the day, the police were appealing for video and footage to help their inquiries. So there are contradictions, and it's impossible to have one rule fits all. I think it's just a case of people acting with common sense, and there are going to be mistakes made, but you can't control the media.
Well, it's a very difficult and challenging environment for all media to operate in. But in the meantime, Phil Hall, many thanks for joining us on World in Focus.
Pleasure.
Breaking news, expert analysis, and exclusive stories, all in one place. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
And we have some further breaking news within the past few minutes. The Met police have now named Khalid Massoud, a 52-year-old with a string of aliases, as the suspect police shot dead in front of the House of Commons yesterday. It's believed that he had been living in the West Midlands, but was not subject to police surveillance. He was known to police and has a range of previous convictions for assaults, including GBH, possession of offensive weapons and public order offences. He has no previous convictions for terrorism-related offences, according to the police. So this is a fast-moving and developing story, and we'll provide more updates on this as soon as they emerge.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, a new study by the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, or ISPU, seeks to offer insight into the often marginalised and misrepresented Muslim community in America. We'll be hearing from the director of the ISPU, Dalia Mogahid, about the findings of this new report. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
We'll do one together, you ready? Are you ready? Max and Stacey together having oral sex. Here we go. 3, 2. Hi, Stacey.
Double down, double down.
I'm doubling down with you, baby.
Double down.
We got a new show on Sputnik.
It's markets, finance, business, economics, ka-ching, bling, and...
all kinds of good stuff. Only on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Doubling down.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much.
We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me back, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one, better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, a new study by the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, or ISPU, seeks to offer insight into the often marginalised and misrepresented Muslim community in America. We'll be hearing from the director of ISPU, Dalia Mogahid, about the findings of this new report. Throughout the American election campaigns and ever since President Trump took office, we've heard a lot about the American Muslim population. Despite being widely talked about, it is often considered to be one of the most misunderstood and misrepresented communities. A new survey by the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, or ISPU, released this week, seeks to shed light on the realities of Muslim life in America. The report consists of findings from interviews with around 2,400 American residents from various religious backgrounds, including around 800 Muslims. Its key findings show that the American Muslim community is more liberal and younger than other religious groups, but also anxious and fearful of what is currently happening in America. There is evidence of optimism in the Muslim community, with Muslims being the faith group most satisfied with the current trajectory of the nation. However, they are the least likely faith group to support a Trump presidency. The Muslim and Jewish communities reported the highest levels of fear in the current climate in America, with 38% of Muslims, 27% of Jews expressing fear for their safety from white supremacist groups. That compares with 8% and 11% of Catholics and Protestants, respectively. Nearly one-fifth of Muslims even made plans to leave the country, quote, if it becomes necessary. Earlier today, I spoke to Dalia Mogahid, the director of ISPU and author of the report entitled American Muslim Poll 2017, Muslims at the Crossroads, and I began by asking her about the motivation for this study.
Our motivation for carrying out this study was that as a research organization focused on the American Muslim community, we felt that there was a gap in knowledge as to what American Muslims really thought. We have been hearing so many things about this community for the past 2 years during our presidential campaign, and yet very seldom do we actually hear from Muslims themselves. And so this was our opportunity to fill that knowledge gap.
Mm-hmm. Now, it may seem a little contradictory that the Muslim community reports being the most satisfied faith group with the country's trajectory, despite being the least likely faith group to favour a Trump presidency. Now, is this perhaps due to their support and engagement with civil liberty groups like Black Lives Matter?
The optimism shown by American Muslims is not unusual for this poll because many other studies have found the same thing. It is a reflection generally, I think, of a community that often wants to look on the bright side and just holds a degree of optimism that is higher than many other faith communities in America. I think the other thing is, you're right, I think they are looking at some of the silver linings in the current situation, where there is a great deal more solidarity with other groups that have been targeted, like Black Lives Matter. There is a heightened awareness now among many Americans of the problem of bigotry. And I think that additional support might be helping to make people feel less pessimistic.
Mm-hmm. But with that optimism in mind, is it perhaps quite upsetting that such high proportions of the Muslim community and the Jewish community have expressed fear and anxiety over the threat of the likes of white supremacists since the Trump election, with one-fifth of Muslims saying that they may leave the country if necessary?
Yes, it really underscores the degree to which Muslims are both suffering, but also taking action. They are responding to prejudice with resilience instead of pessimism or passivity. And I think that that's really the story out of this poll, is despite being the most targeted at airports, the most discriminated against just in their daily lives, and the most fearful of being victims of a hate crime, they are still the most optimistic, and they are still people who are the most likely to have taken action as a result of the election.
Mm-hmm. And looking at some of the other findings, we often hear people voicing criticisms of the Muslim community and across Europe as well, stating that Muslim women are more repressed than non-Muslim women, and there's a perception that domestic violence is more common. But this isn't what your survey suggests, is it?
It's not at all. Domestic violence is a human problem. It is not the exclusive problem of any one faith group or community, and that's exactly what we found in our poll, where almost every faith group we surveyed had equal frequency of domestic violence. Muslims are as likely as Protestants, Catholics, non-affiliated Americans, and the general public to have had incidents of domestic violence in their community. So this has to be dealt with really in cooperation with other faith communities as a human problem, rather than essentializing it to one community or another. The other thing is that so much of our data contradicts conventional wisdom when it comes to women. Women surpass men in education, for example, in the American Muslim community. They are as likely as men to attend a mosque and to value their faith. They are not, as a group, leaving their faith or shunning their faith. The other thing to keep in mind is Muslim women, because of this rhetoric and because of this hateful climate, are the most targeted. They are the most likely to report discrimination. They're the most likely to say that they fear for their personal safety from white supremacist groups. And despite this, they are responding again with resilience. They're not hiding. They're as likely as men to say that they're not changing anything about their appearance so as to be less identified as a Muslim. And instead of hiding, they're responding by contributing more, by joining a civil society organization for the first time, for example, more likely to have done so than men, to join self-defense classes as a result of perhaps feeling more insecure versus changing their identity.
Mm-hmm. And just how likely is it that the average American, to use a vague term, will engage with this report and reports like this and perhaps allow it to change their preconceived ideas that they hold?
Well, as a researcher, we're always struggling with getting the attention of the average American to any kind of research, of course. But I will say that we've been pleased with the media attention that we've gotten for this poll so far. And I will also say that when the average American does engage, when their attention is focused on research like this, it actually does change their mind. And we've seen this in scientific research, where after viewing a video of, in fact, of a video of our previous poll, last year's poll, people actually were more likely to see Muslims in a more humanized image. So I am, again, reinvigorated to keep working at this, because research does matter and facts can truly overcome fear.
Mm-hmm. And to ask you one last question, and it's perhaps a bit of a generic question, I apologise, but what, if anything, surprised you the most about the findings?
One of the most surprising things for me is the level of support that American Muslims had for Black Lives Matter. And that surprised me because I just simply wasn't sure where that would land. I didn't know if Muslims are going to buy into the propaganda from the right, that this was an unruly, you know, movement or a movement that was lawless or whatever. And I was really glad, frankly, to see that they had cut through that propaganda and seen the vast majority have seen it as just simply a movement that is resisting the same kind of bigotry that is targeting the Muslim community. I will also add, of course, that 25% of American Muslims are also Black. So these two communities are by no means mutually exclusive.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dalia Magahed, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. It's a pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at sputniknews.com.
And finally for today, ordinarily at this stage of the show, we would leave you with a funny, often tedious, light story. Given the content of today's show, that did not seem appropriate today. For those in London, life goes on, and if you would like to witness for yourself the defiance and resilience of those in London, just go on Twitter and look at the hashtag #WeAreNotAfraid. That's all we have time for this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh, and in just a moment we'll be handing over to Washington DC for the Tom Hartman Show. And until tomorrow, from me, Carolyn Scott, and from all the team here at World in Focus, goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Black mayor, black chief of police. I would say the thing that is missing is a black middle class who actually have good manufacturing jobs in the area, which just doesn't exist because of our insane trade policies. We have run up this multi-trillion dollar trade deficit. We buy all this junk from low-wage countries. They end up with our dollars. They don't want to buy anything we make, so they come over here and they buy our buildings and whatnot. You can't have a middle class if you don't have manufacturing.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Hi, this is Max Kaiser for Double Down. New show on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Everybody's doubling down. Central bankers are doubling down. Gambleaholics are doubling down. Everyone's doubling down. Why don't you double down? Right here at Sputnik with a new show called Double Down with Max and Stacey. Bye, y'all.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.